Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, episode 96.
It's okay. It's okay. I'm a friend. I won't hurt you. Come on.
Darlings!
Wait.
The soil of a man's heart, Lewis, is stonier. Like the soil up there in the old Micmac burying ground. The person you put up there ain't the person that comes back. It may look like that person, but it ain't that person. Because whatever lives in the ground beyond that cemetery ain't human at all. Sometimes, dead is better.
Simon? Cariño? Cariño? Simón?
¿Simón? Simón, hijo.
Mom, what are you doing here in the middle of the night?
You're just in time for supper, dear.
You're not my mother. My mother doesn't have
buttons. Do you like them? I'm your other mother, silly. Now go tell your other father that supper's ready. Well, go on.
He's in his study. Hello?
Hello, Coraline. Want to hear my new song?
My father can't play piano.
No need to. This piano plays me.
Making up a song about Coraline. She's a peach, she's a doll, she's a pal of mine. She's as cute as a button in the eyes of everyone who ever laid their eyes on.
Sorry, but she said to tell you the food's ready.
Who's starving? Raise your hand.
Hello, and welcome to the Plain Label Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Zelag, and along with me, I have my good friend and co-host, Eric Beverly Williams.
I don't know why I'm always surprised by the middle name. It always makes me laugh. Hello.
In this episode, we are concluding our look at horror movies with a discussion on the films Don't Look Now, Pet Cemetery, The Orphanage, Oxford comma, and Coraline. Once again, in this episode, we are joined by Annelle Strauss and Cameron Rice.
Now, hey.
There you go.
We'll let her go first.
Before getting into our discussion, we should mention that we are brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Get your sweet asses to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of their other shows. Okay, Drink, Roll, Call. Eric.
I'll let Strauss go. She's the bartender this evening.
It's just a Onyx Moon red wine from Trader Joe's. Whopping $5, and it's real good.
Real good.
It's real good. What about you, Cameron?
I'm having the traditional Bailey's with some coffee.
Yum.
Cruz, are you going with vodka water?
No, I'm going to say it's one of my favorite beers. It's the Burning Sky from Empyrean.
Oh, okay.
I really like this red ale. I don't know if I like red ales in general. I don't want to know if I want to commit to that, but I'm just saying.
It's not Better World Wheat, but whatever.
Oh, man, every time. Every time we go to Octo Beer Fest, we make that joke. I think it's funny every time.
Yeah, it keeps getting funnier every year that it's been discontinued, right?
Part of it is a tight five.
Right.
All right, Cruz, you ready to kick us off there or what?
I guess.
Okay, well, we're going to begin our discussion. I'll just go ahead and do it. We're going to begin our discussion with the 1973 film. It is Cameron's pick, and it is called Don't Look Now.
They say seeing is believing, but only a split second of time separates the past from the future. The present is crushed between them. A thin thread of life in a skein of death.
Laura!
Who are you looking at?
I don't know what's happening.
You are warned. Things are not what they seem. Don't look now.
What is it, Mr. Baxter? What is it you fear?
Find him.
You must find him.
You must try to warn him back.
It was a warning. It was Christine. She was trying to warn us.
Your life is in danger while you're in Venice.
What is it you fear?
Christine is dead. She is dead.
Did she die suddenly?
No.
John, I wish you'd believe me.
She is dead!
You must find him!
Dead!
You are warned. Things are not what they seem. Don't look now.
John and Laura Baxter are in Venice when they meet a pair of elderly sisters, one of whom claims to be psychic. She insists that she sees the spirit of the Baxter's daughter who recently drowned. Laura is intrigued, but John resists the idea. He, however, seems to have his own psychic flashes, seeing their daughter walk the streets in her red cloak, as well as Laura and the sisters on a funeral gondola.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Cameron, tell me about you and this movie and kind of the reasoning behind why you picked it and all that kind of good stuff.
So my first introduction to this movie was Bravo, maybe like 10 years ago now. Ugh, Jesus. Had that thing like the 100 scariest movie moments.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And they would play about 5 minutes of content in about a half an hour show.
Yeah, but it was a lot of interview and talking heads and like film critics and writers and stuff like that. And that was a way for me at the time as somebody who had like just graduated high school, to kind of learn about different kinds of horror movies from different parts of the world. Cause now whenever they put out a list like that, it's like, movies that make you go, what the fuck? Number one, Saw. And it's like, yeah, no one's ever heard of Saw. Very underground movie.
That was a good voice.
But, yeah. Oh, believe me, it's in my repertoire. but that list, that 100 movies list, there was of course, The Exorcist and the Aliens and stuff like that. But there was also stuff like, The Sentinel and The Changeling and all these kind of like known but not well known or probably forgotten horror movies. And Don't Look Now was one of them. I think it was number 46 or something. And it just kind of grabbed me. And it's the way people were talking about it in that segment was like, it's one of those movies where you're like, what the fuck? And then later taking film classes, you then learn that it also has one of, if not the most famous sex scene of the 70s.
There's sex in this?
Oh,
congrats.
Yeah. this was one of those scenes, like, it was only later trumped by The Postman Only Rings Twice with Jack Nicholson and Jessica Lange, where people were convinced these people had sex for real on camera. Like, convinced. So I wanted to see it, and it finally came out from Criterion. I'd seen it, I rented it, and it was like, okay, DVDs, you know, quality and stuff, but then Criterion has just put it out. So I picked up that, and it looks amazing. I'm also now become a fan of Nicholas Rogue, and my reason for picking this movie is I kind of wanted to pick something that was, like, different in the sense that it's, like, a British horror movie, which tends to be more kind of creepy and have a slower pace, but kind of has you looking in the shadows more, and something that's not just a ghost movie.
Okay. Cruz, I'm guessing this is a first watch for you.
What?
That's, I'm going out on a limb.
Yeah. You know what's funny is the last three words that I wrote in my notes were literally what the fuck, which is hilarious.
It is.
So, yes, this was a first watch for me. Every time I see Donald Sutherland, no matter what, I picture young Donald Sutherland. I always picture Animal House when he doesn't have pants on.
Of course.
So that came full circle real quick. it kept me interested to see what was going on, I guess. I would like someone to explain the ending to me, I think. I'm not sure, so if anybody wants to hop in on that, that'd be super.
Sure, I think we can probably figure that out for you.
Okay.
So, but what did you think of it? Like, how did you enjoy it?
I liked it. It didn't like affect my life in any way, I guess. Okay. I don't know. The bad thing is, like, I don't really see Donald Sutherland in a lot of, like, serious roles, so I have trouble taking him seriously, plus he's a goofy face, if we're being honest, so but yeah, it kept me interested until the end, and then at the end, I really am just intrigued on what everyone else's take is on that, and so that's kind of my, I guess that's kind of my take on that. I don't know.
Okay. Well, Strauss didn't get to see this one.
I saw the middle of it.
She saw parts of it.
There's this one in The Orphanage. I didn't have time to watch all of them.
Yeah.
Popped in for the sex scene, huh?
Actually, I missed out on that. He already sent it back, so I guess we're going to have to get it again.
It's okay.
Rachel can show you next time you guys are around.
It was like watching The Hug on Step Brothers at the end. Only naked people.
Cameron's not shitting. It's quite the elaborate scene, and there's a lot of positioning happening, and it's an extended sort of situation. Well, no pun intended there.
No pun. Damn it.
When I walked in and watched a little bit of it, he was like, "Oh, you missed the sex scene." So definitely that was the first thing Eric had to tell me I missed out on. But
oh, that's fun.
Yeah, I was confused. I saw the middle part, and I was like, is this supposed to be scary? So.
Well, and then she had freaked me out a little bit because, you know, I knew it was, for me, it was a creepy film, but it wasn't, for the majority of the film, it wasn't overtly a horror film.
Right.
Right? And yeah. So I'm like.
More psychological, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And so I did message Cameron and was like, wait, it is Don't Look Now, right? Like, this is the right one because for those long stretches in the middle where it's just kind of like more psychological and more what's actually happening, are these people losing their minds, are they imagining things, you know, that sort of thing. I was like, well, I'm not particularly horrified by it or scared by it. I can see the craft in the filmmaking. And so I wanted to definitely make sure that I was not watching the wrong film. But that being said, I enjoyed it definitely much more than I didn't enjoy it. I thought there were a couple of moments outside of the sex scene that were very striking and very memorable, and I think some of the things work really, really well. And then I sort of could have gone for that slightly brisker of a pace, I guess.
Okay.
At times.
There were definitely scenes that made me, I mean, besides the sex, that made me uncomfortable, I guess, is the word that I would use. Like, oh, what is happening? And, like, especially almost anything with those two women. I'm like, I'm just uncomfortable with them being in this movie in general, I think. I don't know.
I think that's why, to me, like a movie like this is interesting, is it has that 70s pace. It's not in a rush to throw anything at you. It's just like there's a layer of creepiness over the whole thing, but also a layer of sadness because of the beginning, the opening scenes. Mm-hmm. But I like the things I like about this movie quite a bit is that it would be very easy for this movie to, after the death of the daughter, for this movie to then simply become these two people that hate each other. Or blame each other in some way. And there's certainly a layer of that. There's that scene where she was like, you know, you're the one who said the children can go out and play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and said they can do that. Mm-hmm. And he's got a great little response where he's like, thanks for the reminder. or the history lesson is his exact words. But for the most part, you could see that this is a couple that still loves each other. And they still very much care for each other. And also, I got just out the bat, Julie Christie looks amazing in this movie.
Yeah, Julie.
I mean, she's a beautiful woman.
Yes.
But,
yes.
And so so basically the catalyst of this movie is that their daughter dies, they go off on a trip, and the sex scene, I mean, people talk about it, but within the context, and what's interesting about that sex scene is that it was, not originally in the script, and it was something the director came up with.
And it was first day, right?
One of the first, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, they hadn't been filming that long. And the reason behind that is he said, otherwise, this is a movie, we need to see these people care about each other, because otherwise this is a movie that's just about two people arguing whether someone's a psychic or not, and then it ends. Mm-hmm. So we gotta make sure we have, like, some investment in these characters. And I think it works, and the idea behind it is that, because, Julie Christie is willing to believe, and these women come up and say, we've talked to your daughter and she's happy and she's doing well. She says she feels like her old self again. You kind of can get the impression that these two people probably have not slept together since their daughter died.
Mm-hmm. Probably.
And so there's almost like this rediscovering and refinding each other. But at the same time, it's the fact that Donald Sutherland is somebody who is kind of rejecting what these two women are saying.
Oh yeah.
So there's certainly this conflict there. But they don't hate each other, and they're not like, you know, they will spat at each other, but they're not going to be like, you know, fuck you. There's no screaming match. It doesn't become Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in the middle of the movie.
Yeah.
A movie I love, but it's not appropriate for this kind of film.
You know, going back to the actors for a second, one of the things that I did write down was I thought that Donald Sutherland in particular, and granted you have to take the sort of hairstyle for what it is, but I thought he was particularly very good at playing the hurt, raw sort of male lead.
Yeah.
I think we will all agree later when we talk about how that hurt male lead doesn't work. In our next film. So the male lead is, you know, he's very good in this, and I think that he's very believable as just a guy. You know, he's got these sort of psychic things that he's maybe not fully understanding, but he's not some overly brawny, like, or he's not going to outsmart everyone kind of a guy. He's just a guy.
And I kind of like that. Great wool ties. Those wool ties, my God, so good.
Yeah.
the scarves.
Yeah.
He does look good. One of the other scenes that I really liked was that first sequence in the restaurant where they're in the bathroom. And I thought
that was weird.
I thought that was particularly strong and particularly unsettling. And I was like, oh, mm-hmm. What the hell? Like Rachel already said, it's two old women were so uncomfortable to watch, you know, on screen.
Yeah.
And then with the ending, and I think this is, I guess, to somewhat answer Rachel's question, I think what also makes this movie interesting, and what does put it in the kind of suspense horror genre, is throughout the film, peppered throughout the film, you have at the beginning when the slide kind of runs red, so it looks bloody and all this other stuff. But throughout the film, there's this serial killer that's around the area.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in there, and sometimes it's bluntly in there when they're pulling like the body out of the water. But, it doesn't feel like it's the thrust of the story. The thrust of the story is this couple.
Right.
So it's something that's happening around them. It's in the world, but the movie is about this couple and, you know, how are they dealing with their grief? It's also worth noting, I'm sure he's probably said it somewhere. M. Night Shyamalan totally took the red idea.
Oh.
In Sixth Sense, like the red is going to equal death is, this is that movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's essentially directly ripped from this.
Yeah, anytime there's red, there's either a dead body or there's going to be a body or a death or something like that. And the other thing Nicholas Rogue talked about when he was making this movie, when they went to Italy, what's interesting about that area is how sound works. And so that it sounds like someone's going to be walking right in front of you. And you're like, okay, this person's going to appear in front of me because that's how things are sounding. And suddenly they're walking away and you look, and just because that way that area is built, it's this weird cavernous echoey kind of thing.
Well,
so you can never really tell what direction people are coming. And that scene and that kind of thing is shown when Donald Sutherland is walking and there's a scream and you see the little red run by.
Sure.
Yeah. That's
sure.
The part I see.
Yeah.
And Nell definitely had a particular thought about how Italy and Venice looked.
I was like, oh, it looks so gross, but it doesn't mean I don't want to go there. Like,
yeah.
I was like, not underplaying the fact that we're going to visit someday.
She backed that up real quick. She's like, oh, it looks terrible. Then she's like, but we're still going, so.
Oh, no, but I agree. What I like about it does for Italy what Descendants did for Hawaii.
Mm. Yeah, to where it shows you the shitty parts.
Well, not just the shitty parts. You're like, oh, this is just a city.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's a, I mean, it kind of reminded me of, like, the catacombs, because they had all the churchy stuff in it. Also, I think it's an ironic choice that you move to Venice after your child drowned, but I guess that's to me.
Oh, yeah, the water imagery is huge in this movie.
Yeah, okay.
Like, it's red and water.
And here's the thing, Cameron, that here's the reason, or one of the reasons why I couldn't fully get on board with it is, yeah, the pacing, for whatever reason, for this particular film, what didn't quite work for me as well as I feel like it should or typically would. But I felt like there was so many things that were mirrored throughout the film, through either the editing or everything. Like, they set up 99 things and then 99 things completely were paid off at the end, I guess. You know what I mean? Like, it was almost too much of that for me. Like, it was, oh, here's glass breaking, and then we're going to show you some more glass breaking. Here's red, and then we're going to show you some more red. Like, it just kept doing a lot of those similar things over and over and over, I felt like.
See, I would agree with you if this movie wasn't about psychic powers.
Mm.
And the fact that he is a character who has some form of it and is in denial about it.
So you think that is that
and
why...
And that he is being shuttled forward to his death.
Do you think that's why they edit it the way that they do then?
Oh, 100%. The editing in this movie is completely intentional.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a movie that works better on a rewatch.
Maybe.
In a sense where now you know where the scares are and what this is about. Cause if you're sitting there thinking this is going to be a ghost movie, the first 20 minutes and you're kind of waiting for this kind of stuff, then it's just not going to work for you. But I think what it's about is it's about this grieving couple. What it is a psychic denying his psychic abilities, and it kind of gets him killed.
Hmm. Yeah, now
and
let's
that
talk
when he's finally willing to accept it, he is accepting it in the sense that he thinks he is saving the daughter he wasn't able to save.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's.
And it turns out to be the serial killer.
Let's talk about that end with that horrific looking reveal.
So yeah.
I mean. That was one of those things to where that, for me, straddles the line of being what and being, oh, my God, that is terrifying. Because in the context of the film, I was like, oh, that is a thing that could potentially, you know, seep into my dreams. But if I were just to see it, I'd be like, well, that looks weird.
Well, I think you would say that with any movie.
Well, but
if you were just to see some of the creatures from Hellraiser standing around, you'd be like, "What the fuck?"
Not for me.
Not scary.
Yeah, well, I'm such a tough guy, you know. But I think that I don't know. In this one in particular, it was like, "Holy shit, that's really disconcerting," but then also a little silly. You know what I mean?
Well, because it's a real human being. It's not a mask.
Yeah, and it was just the way that she's like slightly shaking her head and
then she like thunks the knife into his neck, like that weird sound effect. But I mean, I guess my problem with it is, yeah, okay, there was like, I mean, I didn't even remember that there was like the serial killer element in it until you mentioned that, because I was so like invested in these two people, I was like not even worried about people pulling bodies out of rivers and shit. But it's just like, I don't know, they like teach you in writing class that if you're gonna do some weird shit, you gotta put like hidden clues in there to, I don't feel like the payoff was set up enough for me, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Like, yeah, there was a serial killer, sure there was a hood, but there wasn't enough, I guess, of a little bit of a even subtle hint for me to not have that turn around and just be a random person, I guess, and just kill him. I was like, who the fuck is this? Like, I just was, maybe like it would have been if she was like weirdly in the background of, you know, like one of the scenes or something. I would have been like, oh my God, is that weird lady? You know, I don't know. I guess like,
well, she's in the background of a couple scenes. If you watch, there's scenes where the two of them are walking and you can see in the distance the Red Hood walking down.
But it's the
direction.
Hood. I need to face.
Oh, I thought
like,
that
the red...
was the daughter.
Yeah, the Red Hood to me is like...
You're supposed to think it's the daughter.
Okay.
Right. But I'm just saying like... And I get that, but like... It's almost like... I needed to be at least someone I semi-recognize for it to pay off for me. Not just some random person.
Well, I think that makes it Scooby-Doo then. You're watching a Scooby-Doo episode. If it turns out to be the priest or something, I think that makes it cheap. I think the fact that the reason it's slightly horrifying is it is a quote-unquote random act. What are the chances of this American man being killed, who's from England, being killed in Italy? But it happens because of the psychic abilities and what it's barreling him towards.
That's fine. I'm totally on board with that. Like, he should have got his shit together a long time ago. And it doesn't have to be somebody they know. It just, like, I was just really, I guess, confused. I'm like, is this some sort of creepy church person that lives up in the rafters? Or, like, I did not make the connection that person was the serial killer. And so I was just, like, really confused at the end of this movie. I was just like...
Rachel, I think part of the deal is, like Cameron was saying, is that the main thrust and the main point of the film is about the relationship, not necessarily about the serial killer. So since
right,
that's,
oh yeah.
So
to
since
the point
that's
where
a,
I didn't even notice it.
Yeah, well, since that's more of a background thing, I think that's definitely a one that'll become more clear the more often we would see it.
And I think that's what makes also that ending, to me, work, is that you would feel like it came out of nowhere. And then if you watch the movie again, you're like, oh no, this is clearly, here's all, like, it's just as if someone made a puzzle in the dark and you could slightly see it being made. I think had there been too many, like, to me, some of the stuff, like the pulling the body out of the water, there's even a conversation with the priest where he's like, well, we have a serial killer in the area, blah, blah, blah. I almost thought for a minute Eric was going to come on and be like, so blunt, I got it. The ending didn't surprise me.
No.
They had conversations about it.
No, I didn't really have like a critic hat on because I didn't know anything about this one. I mean, for Christ's sake, I didn't even know if it was the right one. So yeah, I was pretty much just going in cruise style. I was just like, all right, let's see what we got.
This ending does two things where I think it wants to almost gut you because the fact that it makes this movie about this couple and that he just dies like feet from his wife who can't get to him because there's a like a fence that he closed. I think it's almost like it's not that it's like they're supposed to be that Jerry Maguire running through the airport scene that he's going to go like pick her up or something, but I think you're supposed to think like it feels like this movie is them rebuilding their relationship. Rediscovering each other, and it's kind of swept up from them. But then with the ending with Julie Christie on the barge with the two women, and then she is like slightly smiling, that works because she fully believes that her husband and daughter are now together again. So it's simultaneously like tragic, and yet there's that little gleam of hope in a way.
Hmm. I can see that.
Sure.
I can see that. All right. Do we have anything else about Don't Look Now?
It's also worth noting this director went on to make The Man Who Fell to Earth, the David Bowie movie, yes. And before that, Walkabout, and Performance with Mick Jagger. So, Steven Soderbergh and Danny Boyle and other other filmmakers have pointed to this movie as huge influences on them.
Filmography, camera.
Steven Soderbergh pointed to this movie specifically, the way the sex scene is structured, as for how he did his sex scene for Out of Sight.
Oh, okay.
And he said everyone was like, oh, that's my favorite scene in the movie is you see them having dinner and then you cut to them getting naked and then you cut back to dinner and all it's this intermixing of time and blah, blah, blah. And he goes, yeah, that's directly ripped off from Don't Look Now.
Huh. I like it. No, I was definitely interested enough to want to see some more of his films. So that may be something we need to get around to eventually.
Yeah, I'm down.
Okay, well, let's go kind of at the other end of the world with our next film. It is from 1983. It is sort of an L's pick, right? Yeah. And it is Pet Sematary.
What is this place?
I brought you here to bury Alan's cat.
Daddy, is church all right?
Why, Judd?
I have no reasons.
I dreamed he got hit by a car and you and Mr. Crandall buried him in the pet cemetery.
What did we do tonight, Judd?
What we did, Lois, was a secret.
May the Lord bless you and keep you.
Has anyone ever buried a person up there?
May the Lord make his face to shine upon you.
You're thinking thoughts that's not thought of.
Something really bad.
You're thinking of putting him up there. Don't deny the thought hadn't crossed your mind.
Come back to me, Gage. Come back to us.
Paramount Pictures presents Stephen King's all-time best-selling tale of horror. Pet Sematary.
The Creed families move to a nice little community, but shortly after the move, their son is killed. Grief-stricken, the father finds out there's a cemetery where you can bury your loved ones, and they can come back to life. He takes his son to this place, and he is brought back. It seems all is well again until the son kills a person. That is where the father learns not everything that comes back is the same. Now he has to find a way to stop his son before he kills the whole town.
Mm-hmm. That's legitimately the entire movie, except for like the last 5 minutes.
Yep.
Man. You know, I don't know why that made me giggle so much.
When we were being introduced, if there would have been space left for Cameron to do his little hello or whatever, I was betting that Cameron was going to say sometimes dead is better in his best Herman Munster voice.
Not this time.
I thought he was going to say, I want to play, Daddy.
Oh, I want to play.
Oh, I much prefer not fair.
Mm.
Oh.
Yeah, and I like that line too. The little drunk baby is what she was thinking.
Yeah, I was
of.
Like, what a drunk baby. He's like, not fair. Yeah. He hits his head on the wall and falls over.
Perfect. That was my favorite scene in the whole movie.
Okay, so let's get around to why we picked Pet Sematary. It kind of fell onto Anel's selection because she hadn't seen it yet. So obviously there's no history there, but she definitely was clued into why Rachel was horrified as a child watching this.
Rachel!
Yeah. Isn't that awesome?
I'm gonna get you.
Cameron, how about we start with you? What's your history with this film?
Pretty much something I saw in high school. I think, something I've seen now and then, again and again. I'm a massive Stephen King fan. I think I'd even say I'm a Stephen King apologist. Like, as far as like his writing goes,
for novels or screenplays or both, or
novels mostly. I do enjoy Maximum Overdrive in a "This was a man who was so high on cocaine that he got to go write and direct a movie," and it's insanity. But no, his novels. I mean, Stephen King to me is a major Whereas Steven Spielberg is a huge part of my film life, I think Stephen King is a huge part of my reading life. And I've read all of his books. Every time a new one comes out, I read it right away. And Pet Sematary might be one of his best novels.
Mm.
And that's the novel.
That's the novel. Cruz, how about you? What do you think about Stephen King as an author? Are you in that world or not?
I respect him as an author. Let's go with that. But he did fuel a lot of my child nightmares with this movie and with It, of course.
Mm-hmm. Pennywise, your favorite.
Yeah, I remember trying to check that book out from the library, and the librarian was like, no, it just wouldn't let me have it.
The end of the book.
How old were you?
10.
You're going to read a 1,000-page book at 10?
I did that all the time, actually. But it had shit in it, so I thought it was cool. So I was like, this book has a swear. I'm going to check it out.
A lot more than that.
Yeah.
Right. Didn't get to read it.
Yeah, Pennywise does some nasty stuff to those kids.
I'm not talking about Pennywise.
It's for the best.
Well.
I was thinking about this when I was watching this movie, and I'm pretty sure that Pet Sematary is one of the first scary movies I'd ever watched.
Oh.
Because, as we all know, I led a sheltered life full of Bruce Willis movies and Hunt for Red October and Star Trek. And so we didn't watch scary movies at our house. And so I watched this at a friend's house. We were having it must have been like junior high because there were boys there and we were doing let's all sit on the couch and watch a movie. And then of course the Rachel scene comes up and everybody's like,
your leg is touching my leg.
Yeah, I know. And everyone's like, Rachel. And I'm like, I think I want to go home. I'm pretty sure I need to leave right now. But I didn't, I was in seventh grade in the car. The other part of this is I'm not even saying dating, but the kid that I was pretending to date at the time, his nephew looked just like that little kid when I met him. And so I was like, what is happening?
You could have been Denise Crosby, Cruz.
That's okay. It's okay. I don't have her bone structure. So it's different. That having been said,
Lieutenant Gar?
Yeah.
Star Trek, yeah. This is the second time that I've watched this movie since then, I'm pretty sure.
Oh,
and a little bit different of a watch now. 20 years later. So, what did everyone else think?
Well, real quick with me and the Stephen King is, I have read much less than I would like to read of his. I've read probably 10 to a dozen or so. I'd like to continue on. It's just, making the time, but he's a guy that's,
you could use Audible.
Yeah, I could.
I'll send you a list.
He's a guy that I would like to read more of. And if I'm looking just at names, I would, of course, Cruz, look at John Irving first. But then I would, for just fun, more of a entertainment slant, I would go, Stephen King. Right?
So, Cameron, I haven't read one of his books. What would be the one that I should read first?
Carrie.
Really? First one?
Okay. I think, now granted, the first time I read it in high school, but I reread it a couple of years ago, I did a reread of his books chronologically. The Stand is amazing, but The Stand is also 800 pages, and it takes maybe 200 to 300 pages before stuff gets, it's a lot of great character building, but it's character building. Mm-hmm. The biggest thing people throw at Stephen King, and I don't think they're wrong, is that he tends to fumble the endings a little bit. And I think that turns a lot of people off right away. And if you're somebody who only cares about the ending and the journey is I don't care about the journey, how's it end? You are not going to like Stephen King. But I think the journeys sometimes he writes are, truly, I think some of them are beautiful. Carrie is probably the most solid.
Okay.
It has a strong ending. It's also an easy read. I think it's only 200 to 300 pages. But it's, I hear what you're saying, Eric, and I don't disagree that it's Stephen King is certainly entertaining. He's popcorn. That's, but there's also what people don't talk about. There's certainly a layer of sadness to a lot of his books.
Mm.
Oh,
well, yeah, The Shining is awfully sad. I feel
The Shining is very sad. I think I will not deny that by the end of it, I get a little choked up by those friendships. The Stand, when one of the girls finds her mother, there's, Stephen King, a lot of his, I think it's on the Green Mile, DVD. They talk about, like, he is, oh my God, I can't remember the artist's name at this point. That's driving me insane. He's a classic Americana artist. He did, all those great portraits of America and all this other stuff. Someone said that is Stephen King of horror. That it is classic 50s-ish, Americana, kids on bikes, picnics, baseball, rock and roll. But it's always, there's this David Lynchian, this town is not what it seems thing to it.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
To answer your question, I think Carrie would be the number one. And if Carrie grabs you, I can recommend more.
Did you guys read The Green Mile when it was coming out in those little 2-chapter things?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you have that, Cruz?
No.
It's, instead of coming out as a book, it was coming out a little bit like how a comic book does, or how it would come out in like the New Yorker or something, to where it would come out in these little square bound 2-chapter, I think it was, or 2 or 3 chapters at a time, and it would come out every couple weeks. And
really?
It was kind of fascinating. It was fascinating to read it like that for me, because it was like almost a self-imposed, Stephen King imposed deadline. To where it's like, well, you better have it read by this time because the next one's coming.
Really?
Next part's coming. And I was like,
yeah, if you go to a Goodwill or anything like that, you will find a lot of those.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about the actual movie then.
Which is worth noting was written by Stephen King. He wrote the screenplay.
Anna's in it as the, at the funeral.
Let me tell you what I do love about this movie. Let me tell you what I do love. The Ramones do the soundtrack, and I love the Ramones.
Mm.
And their Pet Sematary song might be one of my favorite songs of theirs.
So there's a positive.
So yeah, this was my first watch.
Strauss.
Thanks for asking.
Well, we're just now getting to the movie. I knew you hadn't read the book.
So, first watch.
Okay, tell me all about it, Strauss.
Just got done like 20 minutes ago, or however long we've been recording. It was definitely had a few jumpy moments.
Yeah, she was much jumpier. And what was funny is at the beginning, she was really like, oh, this fucking movie.
No, because I said we only had time to watch one. And so it was either Pet Sematary, which was my pick. So I figured I should watch it, or finish The Orphanage, which is what I wanted to watch more of. So when it was starting out and I knew it was an older movie, and I was like, oh, I wish I would have picked, you know, The Orphanage to watch instead. And then I really got into it. So I'm glad. Mm-hmm. I'm glad we watched it. We're still going to watch The Orphanage for me later on, but this was, you know, heartstrings a little bit with children dying and jumpy, and I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
It was good.
Yeah. It was kind of surprising to watch, because it's one of those things where you're watching someone else watch a film for the first time, and you're watching it, you know, much like you, Rachel, I'm watching it for, you know, probably the third or fourth time, but it's been probably 20, 25 years or whatever since the first time I watched it.
Right.
And so I remember watching it when I was, you know, younger and being scared by it. I think the first horror movie that I remember watching was The Cat's Eye, which is also a Stephen King with
Drew Barrymore.
Barrymore, yeah, where the cat like sucks their soul out. Or this little troll does, and this cat goes to save them or whatever, and it fucking freaked me out. And I have to look.
Well, you know how we've talked about how Rachel never watched scary movies? Well, I think last year when we talked about scary movies, I said that my mom would let me watch them, but I watched, like, Chainsaw Massacre and The Screams and around the Chainsaw Coming Back type of stuff. Or even the older ones I would, too. But this is the one that she would say, I'm not going to let you watch it because it'll give you nightmares.
Huh.
So this was the one I guess she protected from me from, and I never had anybody suggest it till now. So,
oh, interesting.
Nightmares from the overacting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's,
or under, yeah, it's depending on the scene.
Oh, what was that, Cruz?
Go ahead, Cruz.
I said or under, depending on the scene.
Mm. Strauss wasn't too much of a fan of the male lead. What did you have to say there?
I said the dad's acting voice is terrible.
Yeah.
Just kind of airy and trying too hard.
She couldn't get over the sort of Days of Our Lives of the male lead.
Right. Well, he is one of my guilty pleasure movies that I watch every once in a while is Love Potion Number 9. with Sandra Bullock from like early 90s, and he's the douchebag boyfriend in that. That's all I picked when he was talking. I'm like, you're kind of a douche. And it kind of carried over into this, so it's fine.
I thought he was brutal.
Listen, let's just get into this. So I posted on Facebook that this didn't hold up. I got a lot of shit for it. This movie's a joke. It's a fucking joke. It's got some good scenes that are still creepy. I think Herman Munster's awesome in it. But Jesus, everyone is here's the problem. Here's the problem. It's directed and everybody is acting as if they are in an Evil Dead or Reanimator movie. And I love those movies. But those are horror comedies, and they lean into both. They have no problem being crazy violent and then having a really wacky Three Stooges-like scene. This has zero intentional comedy. I'm not saying it needs to be as dour or as dark as Don't Look Now or anything like that, but this is supposed to be a movie where the questions are about playing God, grief, death, and facing death for the children for the first time. How do you deal with that? And also now that this couple's moving in, I guess his father-in-law doesn't like him. I don't know, but it's brutal. Yeah. Everyone's terrible in this movie. The little girl is the worst. I am not somebody that hates kid actors. Like, I think I've talked enough on this show and our show, Eric. I'm not the guy who dismisses kid actors. This little girl is terrible. If there was a line of dialogue that didn't have to do with that stupid cat, I don't think she had a line of dialogue.
She reminded me a little bit of Matilda.
Oh, she kind of looks like her in the face a little bit.
Denise Crosby has nothing to do in this movie. The funeral scene is a joke. The guy falls down on his knees and screams no, like it's like he's in a 1980s action movie. But it's not an action movie. This was made by a music video director, and it's really obvious now.
Music video director?
She did all the, like, a lot of famous Madonna videos. This is like one of her first movies, and it shows because everyone's acting like they're in a, if you put this on silent and just play some Madonna music, it'd probably play a lot better.
Oh my gosh.
It's pretty good.
And God loves Stephen King. I don't know. This, Pet Sematary is probably one of his best, but the inspiration for Pet Sematary is he lived on a main road where it's very much like the movie. It was a giant road where big rig trucks can go through at like high speeds. And one time his kid was playing near the road and he picked up his son. Apparently this is his story right before he would have been hit by a truck. So he started playing in his mind about what does this mean and how far would I go to bring my child back? All that is rich and great. This is a movie full of people screaming and shouting and yelling. With camera angles. It looks like a TV movie now. People's motivations make no sense. Herman Munster's like, oh, let me take you to the cat. Let me bring the cat back to life. Only to then, like, 10 minutes later be like, yeah, one time my dog came back and it was evil. Also, we brought back a zombie. So you're just like, well, why did you do that?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was something that, you know, I didn't remember it from a long time ago. And watching it this time was like, wait a minute, why is he doing this?
And motivation in horror movies is not something I usually get hung up on. But this character, his whole thing is supposed to be like, don't do this. Don't do it. Don't do it. Except he showed him how to do it.
Yeah, that didn't make any sense this time around. And I do think that, you know, Fred Gwynn as Herman Munster, I love, love, love his voice. And I think that he is the only one who's not at a 10 the majority of the time in the film. I mean, he gets there, his one scene where his hair goes flopping around and he's trying to act super emotional. But I think for the most part, he's, you know, pretty steady. And good Lord, could the movie use a little bit more steady?
He's very good. The stuff with Gage, when Gage comes back as a little evil, it's a little cheesy, but I don't mind it. I don't mind him looking like
Chucky.
A little Chucky thing. The Rachel scene, yes. I think still play creepy. But like the ghost character, who's a major character in the book, who's trying to tell the doctor, be like, don't do this, and try and like help the wife, disappears for like an hour in the movie. You forget he's a character until he pops up again.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh yeah, there's a ghost.
And then he can't leave the semi.
Yeah, and then he's just like, oh, hey, by the way, I'm out, so hope it works out. And you're like, okay.
And I think the ending is supposed to have a sense of tragedy to it. It's like, this guy unintentionally killed his own wife. It drives him mad. And now he's going to, like, bring his wife, who's, like, missing an eyeball and all fucked up, back as well. And his whole thing is, like, it'll work because it's fresh. It'll work because it's fresh. But that's also played like it's a Tales from the Crypt episode. And I love Tales from the Crypt, but, again, that's a horror comedy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's played like a Tales from the Crypt episode. It grabs a knife, cuts to black, and then you hear him go, no! And then you cut to the Ramones playing music. There's no tragedy in this film.
Mm-hmm.
There's no sadness. It's screaming heads. It's a Rob Zombie movie before Rob Zombie was making movies.
Oh, that's a really good comparison to where it has no heart to it.
But at least Rob Zombie has style. You can look at a Rob Zombie frame and go, this looks interesting. Like, the problem with this movie, and I don't necessarily blame the director, but the lighting is so high key. It's such a high key lit movie that it feels like it should have commercial breaks if it wasn't for being so violent.
Yeah.
Well, I did make the note that opening, you have that opening of shot of the Pet Cemetery itself, and I put, wow, this set couldn't have cost them $50 because that looked so cheap with all of the, like, the AstroTurf all over the place, and I was like, this looks horrible. It looks much less scary than I remember it.
And maybe I can't deny, maybe part of it's too, it's like, maybe watching this alone and hoping it would be creepier doesn't work. Maybe this is much more of a party movie. Maybe it's much more something you put on with drinks and chuckle, you know, as opposed to something you're going to watch alone and be like, oh, it's really creepy. Cause then like the stuff that is really creepy, 2 seconds later, you then have like the father character being like, oh my God. Gage.
Yeah.
What do I do?
Like the couple of parts that it was jumpy is like when the surround sound that we have hooked up, you know, he like drops a ball and that jumps just because of the sound. It's not like it's super creepy like some of the scenes that I did see of the orphanage. I was very, very freaked out.
Mm-hmm.
But
did you like the cutting the heels part?
Oh, that was good. I'm going to check my bed now.
That was good. And what was bullshit about it was we're getting close to that scene and her phone starts going off. And then she's like, oh, is this the cutting of the Achilles part? And I'm like, God damn it.
I was prepared.
You know, and I'm like, this is bullshit. Like, this is one of the things I know is still going to make her squirm. And then she's already like ready for it.
Right.
Distracted.
Yeah. But the whole, I mean, I still think that the Rachel stuff I think is really good still. Like, I genuinely like that.
I think it's stupid.
And so I think that whole little subplot is really scary and freaky. And the thing I remember this movie for is the sister being in the corner running towards the camera.
Yep, I didn't. And that was I the still thing didn't from, watch that, by the way.
Yeah, that was the thing from a little kid that I was freaked out the most by. And it still is the one that, you know, even today gave me little goosebumps on my arms because I just have bad memories of that one specific scene. So anyway, anybody else have anything else about Pet Cemetery? I think Cameron's pretty well on one side of the fence.
Hey, Daddy, how's church? I had a dream about church. Can you say hi to church?
By the way, I've seen a runover cat, and it didn't look anything like that cat.
Oh, it looked a little more flat and not just stuck to the ground?
Yeah, and the eyeball popped out, so they need a little more credibility.
Sons of bitches. Okay, so let's go ahead and move on, Cruz, and we're going to go to 2007, and it is The Orphanage. It is my pick.
Simon!
There are children who can see a hidden world whose imagination opens their eyes.
Thank you.
disappearance. A dark place. Games children play. When they're alone in the dark. The Orphanage.
Laura, a former orphan, raises her adopted son, Simon, together with her husband, Carlos, in an old house and former orphanage where she was raised. While at the orphanage, Simon tells Laura he has 5 invisible friends, which she believes are a product of his active imagination. Laura decides to reopen the orphanage to cater for disabled children and throws a party. During the party, Simon tries to persuade Laura to go and take a look at his friend's cabin, but she's too busy. Cabin. Later on, she sees a mysterious masked boy and realizes that Simon has also disappeared. Laura feels the presence of other people in the house, and months later, she invites a team of parapsychologists to try to unravel the mystery.
Yeah, and before we get going any further, we should mention that Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/plainlabelpodcast and choose from over 180,000 audio programs. Download a title for free and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audibletrial.com/plainlabelpodcast and get started today.
Good job.
So, this is my pick. This is a movie that I believe I saw the trailer and saw the 1-2-3 knock on the door.
Oh.
And it's like, holy fuck, that movie's going to freak me out. I had only watched it once prior to this. It was one that, you know, I'll say sometimes on the show that I don't take notes occasionally because I get too wrapped up into what's going on screen. This is sort of one of those movies because I feel like I have to be totally immersed into it for all of the scares to work properly, and so I tried to not just sit and take notes and pick it apart like I do sometimes.
Sure.
So that being said, I watched it a couple years ago. I watched it yesterday or whenever it was, and still really enjoyed it. I really found it to be creepy. I thought I really liked the perspective that it's just told through this one woman's point of view, and that she's pretty capable as far as horror females go. I like that she is not some dumb 20-year-old blonde type of a character. I like that she's a...
Someone's got to move their phone.
Yeah, I was going to say,
oh,
I think it's
sorry.
You.
There's an Amber Alert, that's why.
Okay, and so I have... I don't know, I have mostly good things to say about it. I know that I was a little disappointed with the amount of scares towards the end the first time I saw it. And then this time I saw it, it got me a little more emotional than I was expecting. And I found it to be really affecting in that way, as opposed to just in quotations, being a horror movie. So this is the one that Anel watched, not all of the first, but the first... maybe like 45 minutes or so.
Yeah. I saw some good stuff. I'm excited to see it, but I understand we have to talk about it. So, you know, spoilers are spoilers, but I'm still going to watch it and be scared. So it'll be fine.
Yeah. It's one of those where I'll keep the disc for a couple extra days and we'll get around to it eventually. But, so Cruz, what did you think of, The Orphanage?
First of all, I would like to point out that our themeception for this time is creepy little kid children. Time.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, and wallpaper doors. Anyway, my first note of this movie is subtitles. Of course, Eric, you dick.
Well, yeah.
So I figured that.
Simon.
Mm. First of all, I liked this movie a lot. Actually, it had a lot of creepy elements, and like you said, it did it did kind of pull at the heartstrings a little bit, which is weird to say about a scary movie, but I got that feeling too, like, you just feel really sorry for certain people in this movie, and really weirded out by others. That having been said, I don't care if I'm at a party and there are children, if a kid comes up to me with a creepy mask, I will fucking punt you. I have no qualms. Like, I wouldn't be like, what's wrong? I'd be like, get the fuck away from me. I don't know what you're doing. Just.
And the sound that he was making was like.
Nope. None of that.
Yeah, the weird breathing and the kind of, the sort of nose, it was like a nose movement almost. It was like, it didn't look like it was coming from his chin necessarily, but it looked like it was coming from the middle of his face that was moving out. And I was like, what the fuck is going on under there?
I would knock you down the stairs. Like, I don't care. I'm just saying. And she paid for it. I'm just saying, trying to be nice. And she paid for it.
Yep.
Overall, I feel like this is probably my favorite out of all the ones we watched. And, because it did have like a, you know, a character building and, you know, things going on and very interesting ending. So.
All right, Cameron, what do you think of it?
I think this is a fantastic movie. I saw this in theaters when it came out. And, I mean, obviously for me, a big push of that is that, you know, produced by Guillermo del Toro. This was pretty much almost right after Pan's Labyrinth.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering.
Yeah. She didn't see the credits. So she
I didn't know. Yeah, I had a
totally
feeling.
Makes sense now, right, Strauss?
Sorry, Kevin.
No problem. I mean, he was only a producer. He didn't direct it.
It
has the same sort of vibe.
Yeah. And I think
maybe it was just Spanish. I don't know.
What I like about it is, like, unlike this, also plays in that genre of horror where, you know, like something like Pet Sematary is like, be careful what you wish for, kind of a horror thing. This plays less into the Tales from the Crypt idea of, like, it's a moral story at the end and stuff like that. This has much more of kind of like, it's a it's a tragedy. Like, mm-hmm. the thing you thought was the ghost, the thing you ended up killing was your mother or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, that kind of a, gothic-y story, that has that kind of tragic thing at the end of it. I think, the actress in this movie has such a great expressive face.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene where it's like her face is taking up half the screen as she's hearing these knocking sounds and her eyes go huge.
Yes!
That scene's fantastic. And then what ends up being the ending is like such a, heartbreaking thing. But it works and it feels like it's of course it had to be that kind of a thing.
Yeah, of course, the Peter Pan stuff and the beginning, the story and all that, that's where I was like, oh my God, don't cry. It's a fucking horror movie. What are you doing? You know, and that's when I'm sitting there watching a movie like this and I'm like, you know, good for you. Like, look at the craft to where you're able to create a film where at one moment I know the fucking scares that are coming. I know what the story is and I'm jumping still and I'm having goosebumps and I'm like, holy shit, you know, and then a few moments later, I'm welling up and trying not to cry, you know, and I'm like, God damn, like that's a movie, right? Yeah. I mean, it's just dragging you along, making you feel whatever it wants to. So I quite enjoyed it.
I do that to you.
Yeah. Kind of like what Strauss does.
Yeah, it's interesting that this guy went out to go then direct The Impossible with, Ewan McGregor and Naomi Watts.
I don't believe
that was, I don't like that movie.
Which was like, run white people.
Well, it was like, not to get off on a tangent, but like, wasn't that the one with like the tsunami?
Yes.
Yes, and she, like, I stopped watching the scene where she was like, in the water, just getting slammed into by trees and shit, cause I was like, I don't wanna deal with this. I don't like that at all.
And now he's supposed to be doing the World War Z sequel.
Yeah, I saw that. That's a really odd choice. From 2007, and he took 5 years before The Impossible came out, and then now it's another 5 years before World War Z 2 is supposed to... Well, he's got a Monster Calls. That's what he's in post-production on.
Oh, okay. Well, let's hope.
Yeah, I don't know. It's got Liam Neeson and Sigourney Weaver in it, so.
She's still alive.
Which is a sign of nothing.
Yeah.
The one thing I think, speaking of Stephen King, that this movie was missing was the Carrie moment at the end. I was hoping for that, but it didn't happen.
You're hoping for the mom to lose it, or what?
No, I was hoping for, at the end, when he's, like, putting the flowers on the monument, that we would have, like, the hand come through the grass and, like, take him down. But that, I mean, in my version of that, it didn't happen. I don't know about you guys, so.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that the first time I watched it, I was so ready just to be scared and just to have moments like the return to the 1-2-3 knock on the door, you know, when she finally gets the people to return. I was ready for something like that to be more prevalent in the film. And when it wasn't that, at first I was kind of struggling against my wants and my expectations for the film. But this time, knowing exactly how it was going to happen, I was like, oh, okay, I like this much better because it seems like a deeper experience than just a lot of jumps and scares.
Right.
You know, and I guess a good comparison would be a film that is like this, that does the thing that this film is able to do, and then a film like The Taking of Deborah Logan that we talked about last time we recorded and a couple of episodes ago that Annelle and I did. And that was a good film, and it did what it was trying to do, but it wasn't trying to do anything other than just scare you all of the time. And so you walk away going, wow, that was scary. And then you kind of forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't stick with you like a film like this one will.
I can tell already, even though I haven't seen it all, it's already stuck with me to the point where I came home and was like, I can't wait to watch the rest.
Mm-hmm.
Do they end up figuring out when they do the fun hide-and-seek game,
mm-hmm.
and they find the gold coins and he gets to make a wish? Do you find out if that is the ghost or if that was him that already knew?
Yeah, all of that stuff's explained.
Okay.
Yeah.
Never mind.
All right. That's pretty short and sweet. There's not a lot of controversy for the orphanage, right?
Right.
No. Okay. All right. Cameron, you're not all hot and bothered about the acting in this one?
No, because it's good.
Okay, well, let's move on to our last film. This is Rachel's pick. It is from 2009, and it is Coraline.
Coraline Jones always dreamed of finding a better world. A world more exciting than this. But never did she imagine that she'd discover it in her own home. A parallel place.
We've been waiting for you, Coraline.
Where parents are always fun.
I love your garden!
Can't believe you did this!
And everything is so good.
Shaking, baby.
It just can't be real.
Mom? You're just in time for supper, dear.
You're not my mother. My mother doesn't have...
Buttons? Do you like them? I'm your other mother, silly.
You probably think this world is a dream come true.
My name!
But you're wrong.
You do like it here, don't you, Coraline? You could stay here forever. There's one tiny little thing we need to do. Black is traditional.
She's got this whole world where everything's better, but it's all a trap.
You may come out when you've learned to be a loving daughter.
From Henry Selick, the director of The Nightmare Before Christmas, comes a world of extraordinary imagination. Spooky secrets.
Who are you? You're in terrible danger, girl.
And daring discoveries.
I still have to find my parents to set them free.
This year, when adventure comes knocking,
choo-choo.
There are some doors that should never be opened.
I'm not scared!
Coraline.
written for the screen and directed by Henry Selick. Presented in Real D3D.
A young girl walks through a secret door in her new home and discovers an alternate version of her life. On the surface, this parallel reality is eerily similar to her real life, only much better. When her adventure turns dangerous and her counterfeit parents, including other mother, try to keep her forever, Coraline must count on her resourcefulness, determination, and bravery to get back home and save her family. Blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm. So why'd you pick this one, Cruz?
Because this was one, like, where I love Tim Burton movies, and so, like, I will watch Corpse Bride, like, in the background while I'm, like, cleaning. It's, like, one of my go-tos. And obviously Nightmare Before Christmas. And this kind of was, like, down the alley where I thought it would be, like, you know, I mean, Tim Burton obviously, like, doesn't have normal Disney princess-looking characters, and so I thought this was going to be kind of like that, only it turned out to be just, like, really creepy and horrifying to me, to the point where, like, they have, like, I thought it was going to be, you know, kind of like a fun, quirky Tim Burton movie, and it was like, what the fuck is, why is all of this happening? And why does everyone have, and button eyes apparently scare the shit out of me, so, I mean, just so everybody knows. So I watched it, like, randomly one day on, like, Netflix or something, and I, like I said, I thought it was going to be something, and it turned out to be something completely different, and so I just was like, let's just watch it.
Sure, okay. Cameron, you want to talk about Henry Selick and Neil Gaiman and all of that stuff, or do you have a lot of things to say about the Coraline, or what?
Yeah, I saw this in theaters when it came out. I really dug it quite a bit. It also showed me, truthfully, why Nightmare Before Christmas stands out and why other Tim Burton claymation stuff I forget about the second I see it. It just shows you what Henry Selick brings to the table.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I think there's a genuine sense of glee. Like, the stuff is creepy, but it's fun creepy. Cause I think some people, it's easy for some people to forget that with Nightmare Before Christmas, that was a lot of Tim Burton had drawings and said, these are my characters, and that's, that, he was definitely involved with producing, but he was also making Batman Returns at the time. Mm-hmm. Little busy. So I think Henry Selick does not get enough credit for directing Nightmare. I think a lot of people think, Tim Burton directed Nightmare Before Christmas.
Well, it's because it's got his name on it, right?
Yeah, and that's exactly why. But in fact, it's a Henry Selick film. Henry Selick directed it, and then he directed this, Coraline. And I think it's fun. I think it's like, it has joy, you know, like there's the creepy kid laughing kind of joy to this horror stuff. Whereas like Corpse Bride and Frankenweenie just kind of come off a little self-serious.
No, just I love something. Corpse Bride. Sorry.
Yeah, that's cool. It just comes off like his films now, like, I miss 90s Tim, like late 80s, 90s Tim Burton so badly. Like, at this point now, Tim Burton is essentially a filter on Instagram.
So, Planet of the Apes no good, or?
Oh, the last good movie he made was Big Fish.
Oh, that was good.
I love that movie.
I'm gonna say Cruz and I talk about that. Yeah, it's sepia tone and then Tim Burton.
Big Fish is fantastic, and then essentially everything else he takes a story and then puts on the Tim Burton Instagram filter. Mm. It's gonna have stripes and pale people, and they're gonna be slightly socially awkward, and Danny Elfman music. There's your Tim Burton movie. Helen Bonham Carter's gonna be the female lead. It doesn't matter if she's appropriate for the role or not. Johnny Depp's gonna be the lead. He's not appropriate for the role or not.
He's doing this book that I read called Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. It's apparently in post-production, and I read that book and I thought it was super creepy and really good. So I'm actually kind of excited to see what comes of that.
Mm.
And from what I'm looking at, Helena Bonham Carter is not in it, so I'm sorry to disappoint you.
They got divorced, so I'm sure.
Surprise, surprise.
I'm sure they're done working together, but I'm sure, I don't know. You know, you look at movies like Crimson Peak and Stoker and stuff like that, and I'm like, this is what, you know, this is not my own original thought, but it's definitely like Tim Burton should be making these kinds of movies.
Hmm.
Like why he's making, you know, PG movies all the time now. Like, except for like Sweeney Todd. He's always like, I don't know. I don't know what happened to him. I don't think he cares anymore. but anyway, Coraline's great. It's fun. It's imaginative. It has life. It's vital. And it has a They Might Be Giants song.
That's true. All right, let's.
What was that?
They Might Be Giants.
Oh yeah.
Let's go to Strauss, who's seen this movie probably more than the rest of us put together, because we have a little one that is
she loves this movie very much
into this movie. So Strauss, tell me about you and Coraline.
I'd say this is probably one of Anna's favorite movies, top five for sure, especially with the amount of times that I've seen it, and which was surprising for me because when we first watched it together, I felt like it was creepy. Like I got that Rachel vibe, like, should I be letting her watch this? Because I know it was a couple years ago, and I just felt like, I think actually she was four. I think it was like 3 years ago, and I felt a little weird letting her watch it. But as we watched it together, she was intrigued, and I think it was definitely like the cinematography of it, and she was like watching her be so intrigued by it. I was like, oh, I guess if she likes it, and it's just held its, you know, truth. Like she still loves it. Just the other day, she watched it with Eric. He took a nap, but she still watched the whole thing. And so I've seen it many a times, and our favorite part is like when the little mice are dancing with the neighbor that loves cheese, and they're like, and they're bouncing around and they're having their little like mice time. And so we sometimes just sing that song in our house. So it's definitely not a creepy movie for us. And she goes, so why doesn't Rachel like it? Because I was like, guess who out of us pick this as their scary movie? And she was like, Rachel? I was like, yeah. She's like, well, why doesn't Rachel like it? Like, The Nightmare Before Christmas isn't scary. I was like, I don't know. She thinks it's scary. She was like, well, that's silly.
Shaming you already,
Chris.
She
wants to have a conversation with you.
All right.
Although, one of the conversations we did get to have today was about the boobs out and the butt out.
Yeah, when the old ladies from downstairs.
Oh, yeah.
She just thinks it's hilarious how much their boobs and their butts swing around, and she's so interested in things like that right now.
Well, the one lady just had pasties on.
Yeah
she just had pasty nipple pasting things. Yeah, Anna loves it.
I would love to talk about what I thought about this movie, but I think in the first time in like 96 episodes, I didn't watch all of this. I made it halfway and took a nap. And figured I would just depend upon the wisdom of Ms. Strauss to carry me through. And I had Anna explain the movie to me, which was interesting because
it was
she's
so cute to hear her explain.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, I was thinking I was getting like 5 minutes, and it was like 20 minutes, it felt like. Of,
don't you know what kids are like when they're passionate?
Yeah. Oh, and yeah. And this guy, he was, well, not this guy, but it was the other guy.
Names of everyone. Like, I called them the old ladies and the neighbor. She knew their names.
Mm-hmm. But that was super entertaining, and I kept seeing, like, okay, well, what happens? Like, what is it that's actually happening? Is it the other mother? Is that the one that's doing it? Because the parts of when I was watching it, I was like, whoa, this... I mean, I know that it's probably said often, but just the look of the film is just something like this, and Nightmare and Corpse Bride. I mean, it's just the amount of patience and attention to detail. And, I mean, it's mind boggling to me to where now it seems like we've got to slap all of the CGI together to make this shitty action movie or whatever. I just feel like
this is the difference for me between Coraline and the two Tim Burton ones, like Frankenweenie. And Corpse Bride. What I love about this is it feels like it's not embarrassed to be stop motion and claymation. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, you know, there's like Frankenweenie, it's like, oh, there's kind of these CGI backgrounds and it's really smoothed out, which almost you watching it going like, well, why even bother making it stop motion?
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to smooth it out so much in the computer.
Well, how do you feel about Paranorman?
I like Paranorman. I dig Paranorman.
Oh, yeah.
I still need to see Box Trolls, but I like Paranorman quite a bit.
Oh, I love Box Trolls.
We haven't seen that one yet over here.
It's on Netflix.
Yeah, Anna saw that, but with
Grandma.
Oh,
yeah, with Grandma. Ugh.
Ugh,
probably why I forgot about it.
Yeah.
Oh,
my gosh.
Less said, the better.
So there's a couple scenes that I really like from this movie. When she is having her first dinner at the other mother's house, and, you know, she's hungry because she's her parents are too busy to, you know, get dinner and stuff. Like, I get it. But so she's at the other mother's house, and there's, like, the choo-choo train with gravy, and there's this, like, milkshake chandelier that comes out of the ceiling. And, like, I love how realistic the food looks, and it just makes you kind of want to, like, be in that scene and take a bite. And then another part that looked so realistic is when the other mother is making eggs and frying bacon in the pan. Mm. Do you guys remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And she's in the kitchen. Like, I just love how real they can make it look. And then with the back of the other mother's house in the dad's garden, like how beautiful it can make the flowers look. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think what's
like
nice,
there's beauty in it too.
Yeah, what's nice about the stop motion is when you see something like that and then you see the button eyes, it doesn't have, it has that texture to it. So it has an additional, upsetting feel to it as opposed to just watching an animated feature. You know, it's got that little bit of reality to it to where you're like, ooh, I don't really like that so much. You know, I don't think these button eyes are the sort of thing I need to be dreaming about tonight.
Got it.
Right, Cruiser?
Mm-hmm.
So I can see that. But no, so this is one that Anna owns. This is one that I'll definitely eventually watch. And, you know, it is, I guess, all streaks end eventually, right? So it's the first one that I didn't get all the way through. But I figured with four of us, I'd be all right. Yeah. If it was just me and Cruz, I would have figured it out. But with four of us, I figured I'd be okay not watching
all. Well, with it being a little one's almost favorite movie, you get your shit together.
Well, and the thing is, you know, and Cameron will appreciate this, is we're a little lax on it at the moment, but we definitely are pushing the Miyazaki on her.
Mm.
We've been collecting.
Oh, she loves those movies.
Yeah, we've been collecting the DVDs kind of as we've been going. And for a long time, it was Totoro was her favorite movie. And then now.
Naturally.
Yeah, now out of the Miyazaki canon, it would be Spirited Away, I think, is probably her favorite.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's kind of the way that I fell on the films also, so.
She does like Howl's Moving Castle, though.
I like that one. You like Howl's Moving Castle more than the rest of us do.
Probably.
I like Howl's. Howl's was in my top three.
Yeah. Nice.
Totoro and Nausicaa.
All right, well, do we have anything else about Coraline?
Wait, Cameron, what did you say?
My top three were Nausicaa, Totoro, and Howl.
Yeah, I haven't seen the first one.
Yeah, you haven't seen Nausicaa Valley of the Wind.
Because Eric didn't like it.
Yeah.
That's surprising. That makes sense.
Well, I didn't buy it because I didn't like it.
Cameron,
sorry.
You should send me a list of things that Eric doesn't like that I might like.
Shit.
Can I also send you a list of not taking notes while watching a movie? I'm going to have to get into this one day.
One of these days. For a first time, not supposed to take notes, right, Cameron?
100%. I don't think you should take notes at all.
Well, I don't have a very good memory, so I have to keep track somehow of what I want to say.
Oh, yeah, I would never be able to talk about... Well, I just write down like asshole shit, actually,
well,
in my notes.
That's the thing with notes, and I have friends... I'm just going to get into it. So I have friends on Twitter, too, who love to be like, I'm watching this for the first time. Watch me live tweet. What a douche move. Because this, truthfully, to me, taking notes or live tweeting a first-time watch, I it's the same thing my mom does. It's the young hipster version of what my mom does. Why did that guy shoot that guy?
Mm. Oh.
What's he doing in this room? I don't know. Why don't we watch the fucking movie and figure it out?
Well,
nine times out of ten, you know what notes are? Would they really be eating a Butterfinger? I don't know. You're watching this for the first time. You're 5 minutes in. Why don't you give it a minute? Smartass.
And what's funny is that I'll get on Strauss's case because I'll be like, put your phone away. Put your phone away. Watch the movie. But then if she was taking notes, I would never be like, put your notepad away.
Yeah.
You're watching a movie. You know what I mean?
I sent you this article. There was an article written about people who, they just didn't find Halloween scary. Halloween just was not scary. And they were tweeting during their, this was like a group thing. And they were tweeting their experiences of watching Halloween. And it was all jokes about people's clothes and people's hair and how come they didn't see that guy and whose car and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you're the worst. You're the worst.
because it, all the shit has nothing to do with stuff that's important in film, which is plot, acting, directing, and what the movie's about. It has to do with that tree in the background's fucking weird. Underline that one. Here's my notes for the movie.
I like it, Cameron.
I totally get it. I think that if I was watching the film just to watch the film, I don't know how necessary what notes would be.
Well, I also of the opinion, if you don't remember, it's not worth remembering.
Mm.
Because then it has nothing to do with plot, character development, or directing. I think writing down, like, the scene with the knife. If the scene with the knife was really good, you're going to remember it.
Yeah.
You didn't need to write it down.
You're not
going to sit there going, like, how'd that guy die?
I feel like your idealized version of my memory would agree.
Oh, he has the best memory. Don't believe him.
But I don't know that I honestly would. I would think about it like, oh, yeah, shit, I was going to say that. I was going to talk about that. I completely forgot. But for being someone that is ultra organized and ultra structured, I feel like I would like to have things down so I can refer to them as I go.
Well, that's why I am more about don't do it on a first time watch.
Because sure.
You need to fully experience a movie. I think something like Don't Look Now, if you're taking notes 20 minutes in, you're having your critic hat on and going like, is that going to be explained? Who's this guy? What's with that face? Blah, 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 blah. And it's like, well, you're not really experiencing the story. No one reading a book is going to be like 20 pages in going like, who's Mrs. So-and-so? Should they really afford that house? What's happening in here? What's with this clothes? Whose locket is that? Underline, underline, underline. And then by the end, you're like, oh, I guess that all makes sense. But I couldn't get into the book.
Hmm. I mean, I annotate my books all the time, though.
Oh.
Brutal.
Right. Huh.
I mean, I write down passages that I think are exceptionally
well. You know what? Maybe that's a bad example because books take a long time to read. If you were listening to an Audible book and stopping it every 5 minutes to write down, not plot based stuff, not character based stuff, not the stuff that matters in story. It's crap like this character's wearing a dress.
Eric, well, I do that with books too. I always bend the page or like put a sticky note in something where I'm like, oh my god, that spoke to me.
Yeah, and I guess
speaking to you is totally different than snarky questions.
Oh, sure. Oh, no. Yeah, for a book, I'm talking about like, holy shit, was this well written?
Yeah.
And I'm underlining those sorts of things. So I think that's a different conversation. The thing that I'll say about the movies is Cameron's point of view, which I think is perfectly valid, is also coming from someone that is into improv, right? And thinking on your feet. That's not really my sort of bag.
Right. You're talking to two introverts who have to think about things and then write everything down.
True. But I guess like it's to me, it's more matching the theatrical experience. I'm not going to be able to pause a movie in the theater so I can write down my piffy one-liners.
Mm.
Like,
no, I get it.
It's just not going to happen. Like, you know, it's like you got it. To me, obviously, in life, you have kids walking around. There's noises. There's dogs barking outside. The phone's going to ring. You can't fully get into a movie. But I don't understand why adding to that, I'm going to pause the movie to write stuff down, too.
Mm.
Like, I'm like, that's not immersive. That's like, that's the exact opposite of immersive. It's also, I think, not allowing the story in the film to sweep you up because you're stopping to question things you just saw 2 seconds ago. Or make a note of it or think about it harder than, truthfully, it might be even worth thinking about, depending. Hmm. And that's where I go off on second or third time watches. Sure. Like I've certainly like watching Pet Sematary, I'll definitely be like, Jesus, you know, and maybe like write one little thing down about one little scene, but that's because I've seen Pet Sematary 7 times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's a first time watch and I'm judging someone's acting from Jump Street, that might not be fair. It might be a dream sequence. That might be what the acting is calling for in that scene. Maybe that's the tone of the movie.
It could be. And I do say, you know, and I do make sure and make a point out of the times where I do not take notes, because even if I'm intending to and the sort of film demands my attention enough to where I don't, then, you know, that's a point for the film. A lot of the time in some of the selections that we have, I'm not enjoying the movie enough to be bothered to be swept up by it, if I'm being honest. Like, I'm like, okay, well, this is okay, and then I'll start making notes after a while because I'm not that interested in it, and it helps me stay interested.
Kind of like a bad college class.
Well, kind of, yeah. A little bit, but I mean, like I said, I completely understand where Cameron's coming from.
Yeah.
That's just not the way that I do things, I guess.
Well, being the young buck in this podcast thing, I definitely enjoy watching movies without taking notes, but sometimes I have just write like a little one-liner just to remind myself of a thought that I had, like, hey, this might be good to talk about later, because I'll get swept up in listening to things that you guys say, and I won't remember certain points that I'll want to make, or if we're trying to talk for a certain amount of time, I guess I want to have more to say. But my favorite so far has been talking about Coraline, because I've seen it a million times, and I could probably quote half of the movie, and that's been my favorite so far.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and Elle will also do the thing where she'll be like, oh man, I was going to talk about this, and I forgot. You know, like when we're in a big group discussion to where it bounces all over the place. And she'll say, well, I wanted to talk about this, but I didn't talk about it. So.
Also, we just agreed too much on this episode, so I got to bust your balls.
Oh, well. I hear you. All right. Do we have anything else about note-taking or any of these forum movies or anything like that? Negative? All right, Cruz, it's all you.
If you have any comments for the show or movies you'd like to hear us talk about, please email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow the show over at Twitter at plainlabelpod. Or you can follow us. Eric is at EricWilliams79, and I'm at LadySizzlag. We also have a Facebook page where you can like the show, search Plain Label Podcast. If you wanted to help us out, go to Amazon.com and search for our wish list. It still won't let us put booze on there, but we do have movies, equipment, and a whole host of other goodies if you're in the giving mood. It is Eric's birthday tomorrow, so if you would like to buy him a present,
such as notebooks,
a new notebook.
I need pens. I need those pens that like light up in the dark. So I can take notes in the movie theater. That'd be good.
Oh my gosh.
You buy him some of those Nightmare on Elm Street pep pills so he can sleep, stay awake through Coraline.
It's true.
So yes, get him the weird light up pens and notebooks, please. just search for the wish list called Plain Label Podcast. And we want to thank Anel and Cameron for coming on and discussing some movies with us. You can follow Anel over at Anel Elizabeth. And Cameron, where can people find you on the internet?
Just go to @JurassicAlien. I'll post everything that I'm doing over there.
All right. And thanks for listening. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with some movies about Eric's mom going to college.
Bye, guys.
I put about something. We haven't decided.
Under the arch of a weather steamboat, ancient goblins and wow alone, come at the grand line making a sound. The smell of death is all around. And at night when the cold wind blows, no one cares, nobody knows. I don't wanna be buried in a pet cemetery. Addicted to the sacred place. This ain't a dream, I can't escape. More limbs and fangs that are picking up bones. Spirits moaning among the tombstones. And at night when the moon is bright, someone cries something ain't right. I don't wanna be buried in a pet cemetery. Live my life again. I don't wanna be buried in a pet cemetery. I don't want to live my life again. I feel a chill. Victor is green and flesh is riding away. Skeleton dance, I curse these days. And at night when the wolves cry out, listen close and you can hear me shout.
My life again. I don't.